From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, Berkeley Breathed talks about reviving his popular comic strip Bloom County after having stopped in the 80s. He restarted it over the summer after rereading an old fan letter from Harper Lee urging him to keep his character opus alive.
So that night, I sat down to try the first one in 30 years. And I posted it on Facebook in sort of a what the hell moment, and then it exploded after that.
Also, we talk with fashion designer Donna Karen. She started her career at Anne Klein, but when she began designing clothes she wanted to wear that didn't fit Anne Klein's brand,
they said, "You're fired, but we'll put you into business, and you could do Donna Karen."
Karen has a new memoir, and David Bianculli reviews tonight's second season premiere of the FX series Fargo. That's coming up on Fresh Air. My guest, designer Donna Karen, has dressed people like Barbara Streisand and Bill Clinton when he was president. Her clothes have been worn on many red carpets, but her clothes are also worn at work and on the weekends by people who buy off the rack at shopping malls. A recent New York Times article described Karen's idea of fashion as almost anti-elitist. She was recently described in Women's Wear Daily as one of the most important designers in the history of American fashion. Karen started off as a designer at Anne Klein's and became Anne Klein's assistant. She eventually became the company's chief designer. Karen started her own company in 1984. In 1989, she started her more affordable, casual brand, DKNY. Over the summer, she stepped down from her role as chief designer at Donna Karen International. She's focusing on philanthropic work and her company, Urban Zen. She has a new memoir called My Journey. Donna Karen, welcome to Fresh Air. So what are some of the designs that you introduced that you feel had an effect on the fashion world?
Whoa, I guess the bodysuit. 7 easy pieces, a philosophy of dressing that I felt for women that needed to be on the go from the minute they got up in the morning till going to work.
Explain what 7 easy pieces are.
The 7 easy pieces was a philosophy that I had, that if you had these 7 pieces, you were great to go. I almost took it from a point of view of having a piece of luggage and what would you pack if you traveled. And it started with the bodysuit. And the reason the bodysuit started is because of my practice of yoga. So I was used to wearing a bodysuit, and that's how I started my day. And then either a pair of pants or a skirt or top of some sort. A sweater. I always felt that a leather jacket was great, and a coat. My favorite piece of all is a scarf.
Why?
Because a scarf is one thing that you can wrap it around. You can hide what you want to hide and show what you want to show. And it's sort of like your partner in crime.
So the thing about your 7 easy pieces is that you could travel, you have these 7 pieces, and they could get you through daytime, evening wear. You could, like, you know, match things to suit the occasion of the day, and you wouldn't have to travel with this big wardrobe.
Exactly.
Well, you mentioned the bodysuit. The bodysuit, it's like a one-piece thing that kind of snaps under the crotch, yes?
It's sort of like a leotard. Well, mm-hmm. It is like a leotard, but it's something that I wore every day. And the beauty of the bodysuit, it had all different necklines, different arms. Some were sleeveless, some were off the shoulders, turtlenecks, V-necks.
You've had 2 really big lines under your name, the Donna Karen New York and DKNY. What were the differences between the two?
Well, Donna Karen was a personal wardrobe for myself and my friends. I really never imagined that Donna Karen would grow to the size that it grew. But it was really after designing Anne Klein, I decided I wanted to have a little collection, small little collection for me of my friends, of my 7 easy pieces, starting with the bodysuit. And then my daughter and all her friends started wearing all my clothes, and I needed a pair of jeans. Voila, DKNY.
Because of the jeans or because of your daughter?
Well, it was a double situation. All her friends were borrowing all my clothes, and I said, this has got to stop. And I realized there was a larger market out there for what we were doing. But I wanted to create sort of the 7 easy pieces that I had done for collection, but through a more him and a her point of view, that we all needed a pair of jeans, we needed an anorak jacket, we needed a T-shirt. I love jumpsuits, a blazer, and a pair of jeans.
So what makes a great pair of fitting jeans, since we all are shaped a little differently? Like, what's great fitting for you might not be for me. Do you know what I mean? How do you make a great fitting pair of jeans that will fit women with different body sizes?
Figure types?
And figure types, exactly.
Generally speaking, it's better to have it lower in the front and a little higher in the back.
Yes.
You know, for the curvature of the body.
I agree.
So then when you sit down, it doesn't fall down in the back.
Mm-hmm.
And also where the crotch is created,
yes,
it's better to have the crotch a little bit towards the front as opposed to the back.
Mm-hmm.
And then the cut of the legs, depending on what kind of leg that you want.
You were born into fashion. Your mother was a model who later became a showroom salesperson. Your father, Gabby Fask, made custom suits. He died in a car accident when you were a child. Your stepfather was in the clothing business, too. You say he was on the cheap side of the street selling knockoffs and schmatas. Looking back on your life, as you do in your book, looking back, you think that your mother was bipolar. What makes you think that?
I'm not sure the word would be bipolar, but my mother was a very stressed-out lady. She had a lot on her plate. She was a working woman. In those days, which is quite unusual. She had two children, myself and my sister Gail. And she loved working. You know, the woman who went to work was one thing, and then the woman who came home from work was a little bit of another.
More high-strung after work?
Well, she had a lot of migraines. Mm-hmm. She had to do a lot of work, you know, whether it was the laundry or, you know, making sure she was prepared to go to work. And, you know, in those days, she would go to the beauty parlor on Saturdays and make sure her hair was right for the rest of the week. So it wasn't really fun. It was more rotated around, you know, preparation for her, either tired from a week of work or getting ready for the week to come.
So how did you know you wanted to be a designer?
I didn't. I didn't want to be a designer. The last thing I wanted to do was work on 7th Avenue. I wanted to be a singer like Barbara Streisand. I wanted to be a dancer like Martha Graham. I love the body. I love the movement of the body. But I was neither of them. However, what I decided that I thought I would like to do is be an illustrator. I love drawing. I love drawing bodies. I love drawing fashion, but I wasn't thinking of myself as a designer in those days. And then I went for a job at Women's Wear Daily, and they said, you know, I think maybe you should look at design instead of illustration. I saw that I could not sing like Barbara, and I couldn't dance like Martha, so I was sort of put into the fashion industry. I started working in Sherry's clothing store when I was young, and I love dressing people. I loved helping them find the right clothes. I like working in a retail store, arranging it and making it look really pretty, making it easier for the customer. So I found that I was getting into fashion whether I liked it or not.
You started your career working with Anne Klein. You became a designer there. And Anne Klein got cancer, breast cancer. And you took on an increasing role when she was sick. You had your first child just before she died. And you had hoped to be a stay-at-home mother. But instead, the company called you and said, we need you. You have to be here. You have to help take over. How did you weigh in your mind what to do at that point?
It was such a state of shock for me. They called me as I was having my baby. And I said, would you like to know whether I had a boy or a girl? By the way, it was a little girl. Her name is Gabby. And they said, well, Anne's in the hospital. We have a collection due. And I said, well, I asked my doctor. I said, when can I go back to work? And he says, you just had a 10-pound baby girl. You can't go back to work so fast. You know, you need at least a week. So I said, well, we'll bring the work to you. So we went to my home in Long Island where I had just moved in. And the entire company came to my house, and I thought, how great, bagels and lox and everything else, and see my little baby, Gabby. But as soon as that happened, the phone rang, and Anne died. I had no idea she was as sick as she was. In those days, people really didn't discuss the disease of cancer. And it was a shock, and a collection was due the next day. Actually, they postponed it a day because of the funeral, but the following day the collection did open, and that was pre-fall. And then I had to push up my sleeves and get fall done. It wasn't a question of really thinking this out. It's amazing to me how all of a sudden things happen the way they happen.
So you became like the chief designer at Anne Klein. And what happened to your dream of being a stay-at-home mother? Why was that your dream, first of all?
Coming from a working woman, I said I promised I would never go to work, or I'd never be a working mom.
Because your mother had paid so little attention to you?
I had come from a working mom. Just that I realized, how do you do it all? Mm-hmm. It's really quite hard. It's not an easy, you know, people ask me, how do you do it today? And I'm saying, it's not easy.
And you saw how stressed out she was.
Yeah. And I wanted to have the opportunity to stay home with my daughter. But I guess that's not what the universe had in mind for me.
I want to get back to Anne Klein for a moment. We talked about how her death from breast cancer affected your career and your plans, how it upended your plans to be a stay-at-home mother. But I'm sure you were also very close to her as a person. She had guided you through the early part of your career and given you really big breaks. I'm assuming she was probably the first colleague you were close to who you lost that way. What impact did it have on you personally, her death, and to lose someone you were close to and know that, you know, that these things that
happen.
Yeah, that these things happen.
I was in a state of shock. Anne was like my mom, my second mom. We did everything together. We worked together. I spent the weekends together. She hadn't had any children, and it just kind of worked for both of us. And I think we were sort of the 24/7 working pair, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
That we'd work and play and kind of hang out together. I remember a lot of times hanging out at her beach house in West Hampton.
Did that lead to any conflicts, being close friends and hanging out together in your off time as well as working together?
I never felt that she was my friend as much as my mentor.
Mm-hmm. You left Anne Klein, the company, in an unusual way. After she died, you were the chief designer for a while. They told you that your heart wasn't in the company anymore and you had to leave, but they also told you if you wanted to start your own company that they would be your business partners. Would you explain that exchange a little bit?
Now, I was really surprised. I had this idea of starting a small little company for me and my friends, just 7 easy pieces. I just wanted to design really a little company. So I figured I could do Anne Klein. I did Anne Klein 2, and I felt that was rather easy. But my bosses at the time felt that that wouldn't work, and they wanted 100%, attention put on Anne Klein, which I could understand now, believe me. And they said, basically that I was fired. And I go, what? What do you mean I'm fired? They said, you're fired, but we'll put you into business, and you could do Donna Karan. And I was kind of shocked by the whole thing. But I started Donna Karan right after working at Anne Klein for over 10 years.
Did you see this as a compliment or as an insult?
Both.
On one hand, they were throwing you out the door. On the other hand, they were saying, we're going to help you start your own company, your own
brand. Exactly.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody had realized that Donna Karan would be the size company that it became.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Nor did KMY, for that matter.
Well, your second husband, Stephen Weiss, who became your business partner, he sounds like he really helped build the company on the business end.
Well, he was kind of wonderful. He kind of kept my partners and everybody, all the stuff that I didn't want to deal with, Stephen dealt with. Mm-hmm. And that was great. But Stephen was an artist, and I was really shocked by his genius at business. And he was the one who said that we should start a beauty company. So Stephen, in our own bedroom, would mix the products. He designed the bottles, he mixed the product line and everything, and we started to become in the fragrance business that Stephen himself ran.
There's a funny scene in the book where you wake up and your husband has to go to a business meeting, and he is wearing a brown plaid suit, a tan shirt, and a wide tie. And you write that, like, you almost died looking at him. And you write, if anything could have made me fall out of love with Stephen, that was it. I felt like I'd woken up to a stranger, a man who bore no relationship to the sexy jeans-wearing guy I'd gone to bed with. Why was that suit so upsetting?
It was really in your face. It was almost like a clown suit is the only way that I could describe it. Sort of this brown and beige plaid suit. And I had seen, you know, Stephen as a pair of jeans and a little sexy sweater and top and stuff like that. And all of a sudden I see him wake up one morning and I see him in this suit. And this is way before we got married. This is when I first met him.
Okay.
So I was at Parsons School of Design, and there he was, you know, being the antithesis of everything that I would not want to be with at all.
So how somebody dressed was very important to you, because that was your thing.
Well, I'm a very visceral person. So it's what I see, what I feel, what I touch, what I smell. All of these, you know, senses are very, very heightened as a designer. So, yeah, what I see, has an effect on me.
Did you start dressing him after that?
Yeah. He looked much better in Giorgio Armani.
If you're just joining us, my guest is designer Donna Karan. She has a new memoir called My Journey. Your husband died of lung cancer in 2001, and before he died, he sold your company so that you wouldn't have to worry about the business end of things and so that the family would have financial security after he was gone. So that meant this huge change in your life, both professionally and personally. You no longer owned your company and you no longer had your husband. What did you do to survive that period?
But
should we throw in that 9/11 happened just a couple of months after your husband died and you lived in Manhattan and worked in Manhattan?
After Steve passed, I felt very alone. I felt, you know, how was I going to do this without him? And I had a collection due that was coming up in September. And at that time, 9/11 happened. And that was, our anniversary was that day.
Your anniversary was September 11th?
Our anniversary was September 11th. So the night before, I couldn't go to sleep. I figured, how am I going to do a show? My husband's not going to be there, and it's our anniversary. So I wanted to take a piece of his sculpture, which is a very large piece of sculpture, and have it sit at, I was showing at the Armory at the time. So I asked somebody to please deliver one of my husband's pieces, so at least I'd feel that he had a wired sculpture with a man sitting in a chair, and I thought that would be very cool of having that, because the collection was very much inspired by him, and it had a lot of wiring. But then I got a call that morning. I got woken up. I hadn't slept the night before. And somebody said to me, Donna, life will never be the same. And we were living down on Worcester Street. And I looked outside the window and I saw what was happening. And on TV, it was September 11th and they had just hit the Trade Center. And Patty Cohn, who was in charge of PR and public relations, called and said, don't worry, Donna, the show's going on. And I said, that's the most ridiculous thing I ever heard of. You know, we have a catastrophe on our hands here right now. I can't imagine, you know, doing shows. She said, well, Uptown seemed okay. And then the second plane hit. And then all of a sudden, you know, the city was in complete, utter panic. But the show did not go on. And what we did was they had called us and said, could we use your armory as a holding ground because we felt all the hospitals would be completely jammed up. I said, absolutely, do whatever you need to do. And unfortunately, nobody got to be at the armory. And even in the hospitals, you know, people hadn't made it.
There wasn't that many people to rescue because they were killed.
That's correct.
You've left your company as of July. Why did you leave?
It was a very difficult question. I don't ever feel like I left the company because I feel that the company is there. But I did realize, and I had been struggling it for over past few years, is when I started Urban Zen, I was doing Urban Zen, I was doing Donna Karan, I was doing DKMY. And that was an awful lot to design and be the mother and the grandmother and all of that, and the woman who was traveling all over the world. And I said, there are only X amount of hours in the day. And to do anything right, you know, I had maybe taken on too much, you know, at the stage of life that I'm at. I had a future that I was getting older, and I wanted to say, you know, how did I want to spend the next 10 years of my life?
And it still feels like the right decision?
Now I'm going through a little bit more difficult process. You know, it is a transition that I'm going through. There's no question that I know that I'm doing the right thing. But I still, you know, come September when the shows were going on, I'm going, oh, my God, I don't have to do a show.
Donna Karan, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Donna Karan has written a new memoir called My Journey. After we take a short break, Berkeley Breathed will tell us why he's returned after a long break and restarted his popular comic strip, Bloom County. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Before we get back to Fresh Air, let me tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, the TED Radio Hour. You'll hear questions addressed like, what is the meaning of work? And when does being an amateur trump experience? The TED Radio Hour is about ideas, inventions, fresh approaches to old problems, and new ways to think and create. You can find the TED Radio Hour podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. Berkeley Breathed has brought back his popular comic strip Bloom County after having retired it 25 years ago at the height of its popularity. At the time, Bloom County was published in over 1,200 newspapers. Anthologies that collected the strip were bestsellers. Our producer, Sam Brigger, used to read Bloom County and was pleasantly surprised when he discovered the strip had returned. So he recorded an interview with Berkeley Breathed, which we're about to hear, and Sam is here to introduce it. Sam, how did you find out that Bloom County was back?
Well, I was surprised to find it on Facebook. That's where he's posting it now.
So it's not in newspapers anymore.
That's right. It's no longer newspapers. It's a Facebook-only comic strip.
So Bloom County won a Pulitzer for editorial cartooning, but it's not a strip that was ever on the editorial pages per se.
That's right.
Tell us something about the strip.
Yeah, it was in the funny pages. It took place in a small Midwestern town called Bloom County, and there were a variety of characters, including probably the most famous, which was a penguin named Opus. There were other human characters, and it often lampooned popular culture figures of the day and politicians as well.
Like who?
Well, like Donald Trump, for one.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And he's actually made it back in the new version, Bloom County 2015.
So there's an interesting backstory that you had started telling me about how Berkeley Breathed brought back the strip in part because of his connection to Harper Lee, who wrote To Kill a Mockingbird. And this past summer, the original draft of To Kill a Mockingbird was published under the title of Go Set a Watchman. And he was very upset when it was published.
Yeah, that's right. He had a big emotional reaction to the publication, and mostly because he was upset how the character of Atticus Finch was treated. In the original To Kill a Mockingbird, Atticus Finch is this very heroic character, and in Go Set a Watchman, he's portrayed as a racist. And Berkeley Breathed was worried that this was going to kill off the character in the imagination of readers, and it made him reconsider his own characters.
So why don't we get to that part of the interview that Sam did with Berkeley Breathed?
I watched, slack-jawed in horror, as they threw one of the 20th century's most iconic fictional heroes, Atticus Finch, under the bus. At the time, and this is just a couple of months ago, it made me think that there would have been no Bloom County without Mockingbird. Because I was 12 when I read it, and the book's fictional southern small town of Macomb had settled deep into my graphic imagination and informed it forever. If you look at any of my art for the past 30 years, there's always a small town flavor to it. So this summer, just a couple months ago, when Go Set a Watchman was causing an uproar, I went back to my files and I pulled an old fan letter from years ago. It says, "Dear Mr. Breathed, this is a plea from a dotty old lady and from others not dotty at all. Please don't shut down Opus. Can't you at least give him a reprieve? Opus is simply the best comic strip there is, and depriving him of life is murder. A hard word to describe the obliteration of your creation. but Opus is real. He lives. Harper Lee, Monroeville, Alabama.
Wow.
When I pulled that out, I hadn't seen it for 25 years. And I choked up and I thought about the preposterously ironic impossibility of my literary heroine from my childhood demanding that I not kill one of her fictional heroes. The universe throws us some obvious slow pitches sometimes, and we need to be awake enough not to let them slip by. And so that night, I found the blank four frames of Bloom County from years before in my files, and I sat down to draw the first one in 30 years, and I posted it on Facebook in sort of a what-the-hell moment. And that's exactly how much careful reason, sober forethought went into the whole thing. And then it exploded after that.
Is it strange to return to Bloom County after 25 years? But what comes easier or harder for you now, writing the strip?
Well, no, it's a reverse question. It's why does it come so easy rather than why did it come so hard before, which is what it did. I never met any of my deadlines for 5,000 comic strips in the 10 years that I did Bloom County, not a single one. And it was because I was miserable. I was driven, but every single deadline was ripped out of my back end. I don't know why. I've long examined why that was so difficult and why the strip turned out even readable. But it's such a reverse now that I'm still – it's also new. I'm still trying to figure out and decipher what it is that's happened in the ensuing 25 years that has turned that around into something that I can't wait to get up in the morning to do.
You've written that you would drive yourself really early in the morning to the airport to drop off the week's worth of comic strips to get to the Washington Post where you were syndicated.
Yes. And that was – I was driving material whose ink was still wet because I hadn't started that week's of strips until only about 9 o'clock that night. And by 4 o'clock in the morning, I had to get them to the airport and put them on an airplane to Washington, D.C. It didn't matter if there was a blizzard or an ice storm. And several times I ended up spinning on I-70 on the way down from my home in Evergreen, Colorado. But in Iowa, the weather was so terrible that by the time I got to the airport, often the strips had not been finished. And I had to get on an airplane with the strips, buy a ticket right there, and fly to Washington, D.C. while I finished the last couple of strips on the plane, usually deferring interested parties who are watching me who desperately want to talk about cartooning to me on the plane. And I'd get there and give it to a cab driver and give him $50 and hope that he did what he promised to do and get them to the Washington Post offices. And I'd turn around and get back on the plane and fly back to Iowa.
So for those of our listeners who didn't read Bloom County, can you just briefly describe the strip for us?
Actually, probably not.
Okay.
Can give it a try.
Well, I'll try. I'll give a little bit. There's some famous characters that people might know. It's Opus the Penguin, who is an earnest and innocent penguin. Bill the Cat, who seemed to be in part a parody of popular comics at the time, Garfield. Cutter John, who was a paraplegic Vietnam vet who liked to ride down hills imitating having Star Trek fantasies. There was Steve Dallas, a former frat boy who was a defense lawyer who often could be pretty sleazy. I think those are some of the main characters.
Sure.
Okay.
Nicely done.
You'll accept that. All right. Well, maybe let's look at a couple comics and that will give people a bit of a feeling for it. You actually have in one of the earliest new strips, you have Opus, who seems to have woken up from a sleep after 25 years, who's worried that his friends are going to put him back into hibernation. And he says, no, I'm not going back to sleep. And the horror of 25 years ago, a world of Clinton versus Bush, a world where Arnold Schwarzenegger still acts in movies and Donald Trump runs around, spouting poo-poo sauce and Lhasa Apso hair extensions. Good riddance to that old nightmare. So it seems like it's like you never left.
Oh, exactly right, which is the whole point. Hearing my comic strips read as a transcript,
sorry about that.
Thing.
Yeah, I'll try not to do that again.
Sam, you're going to go to cartoon hell for
yeah,
that.
I apologize.
It's unfortunately something we have to live with, but they have pictures for a reason, let me
tell
you.
I'll just finish out the interview just reading some more of my favorites.
Hey, yeah, you do that. You'll see me out the door.
Let's look at another one of your recent comics, and this one features Binkley, who's a neurotic 10-year-old who has an anxiety closet in his bedroom. And when he's going to sleep at night, various anxieties pop out of his closet to torment him, and usually they're pretty idiosyncratic. So the most recent one has been George Lucas. Why is George Lucas one of his anxieties?
He's back. We're all anticipating the return of Star Wars. And this is a little inside baseball for some of my fans, but they know what I'm talking about, is that George Lucas, who he has a complex relationship, let's say, with his own fans. And they love him and they revere him and they probably bow to him like Binkley does. They all desperately want him to stay back in retirement in their anxiety closets where he's safe from possibly doing any rewrites in any future movies. It brings up one point is in the old days, I would never have hesitated in taking great joy in going after someone like George Lucas, a personality as large as George Lucas. And I pause now, and that's come with age. It doesn't matter how big he is or that he's the king and he's sitting on top of the hill. He's still an artist like I am, and we may tear our hair out over what he's done with his art or where he's taken it. But we forget that he probably has an ego that can be hurt as much as the rest of us. And when I was 23, I would never paused and I certainly spent more time with celebrities than I would now as far as satirical targets. I think I'd approach it with a bit more compassion now. In fact, I know I do. I don't like hurting people's feelings. I remember walking. I was in Santa Barbara maybe 18 months ago. I was scootering with my little boy down State Street, and I pass a fellow and zip right around his feet and keep going, and I realized who it was, and I stopped, and I told my kid to follow me, and I came back and confronted him, which I would never normally do, and it was Barry Manilow.
Who appeared in your strips before. Yeah.
Who appeared many times in my comic strip, and probably not in the most flattering ways. In 1985. In fact, I was probably fairly merciless with him, as well people like Michael Jackson and others. All artists, nobody was hurting anybody. They were just doing their art, and I was going after them, which I thought at the time was part of my job description. And I walked up to him and introduced myself, and he remembered who I was. And we both remember that he sent me a bouquet of flowers when I had broken my back in 1987 in a flying accident. The target of my meanest cartoons sent me a massive bouquet of flowers to my hospital. And we both remembered that, and we laughed about it. And he turned to my son and said, "This is one of the greatest cartoonists of our generation." And I turned to my boy and I said, "This is one of the greatest and most famous singers of our generation." And I realized I don't have it in me now to do that again. It's under the category of things that I do differently now. I'm not the same guy I was in 1985. Fortunately, my sense of humor hasn't completely been defeated. But other than that, there's a few changes.
You won the Pulitzer Prize in 1987 for editorial cartooning, even though Bloom County is not an editorial cartoon, and that created a lot of controversy. What was the issue there?
The issue was that the editorial cartoonists, the conventional ones, the ones that were on the political pages of the newspapers, were incensed. They were mad enough that Trudeau had won it 10 years before, but he was arguably really just a walking, talking editorial cartoon on the comic pages. Mine clearly was not. To wit, it was populated with a penguin and a dead cat. So the idea that I had infringed on their territory was not taken very well. And they let Columbia University know. They let the newspapers know. They released press releases. They spoke out rather vociferously to have my Pulitzer revoked unsuccessfully. And it ended up a very funny scene because Columbia was so embarrassed by this time that they could barely give it to me before kind of ushering me off the stage and telling me to get the hell out of town, which I was happy to do. Never look back.
You said that you would be at a convention and an editorial cartoonist would be at the next table and would leave when they realized who you were.
It was something right out of Bloom County. I was signing autographs next to Pat Oliphant, who was, I think, a double Pulitzer Prize winner at the time.
Who you've said is someone who you admire.
Oh, he was a huge influence. He's one of the best. He was the funniest guy on the editorial pages in the 80s and 90s. And in any other time would have been my hero. He was my hero at the time. So I'm sitting next to my editorial cartoonist hero. And as a counterpoint to Harper Lee, he looks over to me and realizes he's sitting next to me. He gets up, takes all of his materials, and leaves the room. It was putting a point on the attitude that the rest of them had. And when I spoke at the editorial cartoonist convention, they every one of them boycotted it. So all I had in the audience were mostly college cartoonists.
Wow.
Those are fun days.
Yeah, well, he actually said at one point, there's a quote when the Washington Post read about this, that Bloom County was guilty of, quote, passing off shrill potty jokes and grade school sight gags as social commentary.
Guilty. As it should be. He was missing the point.
Back in the 80s when you were syndicated, your strip appeared in over 1,200 newspapers. And I guess each of those papers had an editor for the funny pages. What was your relationship with those people? Would you hear from them if there was something that was too irreverent for their readers? Or what was that situation like?
It's relevant because I'm doing the same comic strip now without any editing whatsoever. And I would say that in 1985, I had 1,200 editors, each of them having a different agenda, each of them having a different audience, every single one of them feeling that they had the right to edit and to, I wouldn't say censor, but manipulate the material. You know, the editor of the Salt Lake City Tribune had a different agenda than the editor of the Boston Herald. And they would be perfectly happy in editing and rewriting each strip as they felt necessary, which left some very funny strips out there. There needs to be a book of the various versions of my comic, of each comic, the more controversial ones as it appeared in papers around the country. There used to be famously an editor at the LA Times whose primary responsibility, he did other things in the newspaper, but for the comics he did one thing, and that was to remove the butt cracks from various comic strips who kept including them as their characters bent over. I think there were a couple with the Cats and Jammer Kids or something. I hope you can say butt crack on Fresh Air, Sam.
You can.
I might be able to. All right.
You can say.
Well, he would have to take his bottle of whiteout and actually white out the butt cracks of the comic strips each day before they posted in the LA Times in the 40s and 50s. So that was the reality of comic strips, is that you were dealing with a medium that had no patience for controversy whatsoever.
Well, I'm so glad that Bloom County's back, but I've seen these characters come and go in the past. Can I be cautiously optimistic that they're going to be around for a while?
I should be careful not to make any promises. How can I say no when I'm having so much fun? I mean, it would have been a hard question to answer in 1988 because I was miserable. But I appreciate that, and I'm certainly hearing that from these remarkable people that are writing to me and to each other every day on Facebook. In the past couple of months, it's been stunning. The digital world has allowed me a connection with my readers that I'd never had before. I wrote every single cartoon strip in isolation in a dining room in an Iowa City farmhouse. I didn't meet the people who read my material. The fan letters were mostly answered by professional people that had done them for a living. And I didn't have any daily connection with their response to my work. So the cartooning was just an abstraction. It was an income. It was making me famous. It was allowing me to go and do other things that I'd wanted to do. But I didn't have a relationship with my audience, and every artist should have it. And I'd like to be able to tell them that, no, I'm not setting themselves up for a quick fall. You're stuck with me for a while.
Well, Berkeley Breathitt, thanks so much for appearing on Fresh Air.
It was my great pleasure, Sam.
Berkeley Breathitt spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. The revived version of Bloom County lives on Facebook. A collection of the new strips will be published in book form this summer by IDW Publishing, which brought out Breathitt's earlier collections. After we take a short break, David Bianculli will review tonight's second season premiere of the FX series Fargo. This is Fresh Air. Before we get back to Fresh Air, let me tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, the TED Radio Hour. You'll hear questions addressed like, what is the meaning of work? And when does being an amateur trump experience? The TED Radio Hour is about ideas, inventions, fresh approaches to old problems, and new ways to think and create. You can find the TED Radio Hour podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. Tonight, the TV drama series Fargo begins its second season on the FX network. It has a new story and a new cast, but one familiar character is at its center. Our TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
Last season, when it premiered, Fargo, the TV series, had to overcome the misconception that it was a remake of Fargo, the fabulous Coen Brothers movie. Instead, this TV Fargo was series creator Noah Hawley's reimagining of the Fargo mood and sensibility. Plot lines and settings were all new, but the style was the same. Characters were quirky, the humor was dark, the violence was shockingly sudden, and the conversations were slow, yet often filled with menace. The Coen brothers liked Hawley's take so much, they not only approved of the TV version, but signed on as executive producers. And as season one's murder case unfurled, with terrific central performances by Martin Freeman, Billy Bob Thornton, Colin Hanks, and Alison Tolman, Fargo more than stood on its own as one of last season's most delicious TV treats. And now it's back for season two. But not one of the actors who made season one so great has returned, because this year's storyline is a prequel to last year's TV show. It's set in 1979 and dramatizes the grisly murders that Keith Carradine's Lou Salverson described in passing in an episode of Fargo's first season. He called it madness, really, a case with a stack of dead bodies. For this season two prequel, we see Lou Salverson as a younger man, a state trooper now played by Patrick Wilson. That's the familiar character, though portrayed by a different actor, at the center of season two of Fargo. And all around him are actors who are just as playful and charismatic. This season's Fargo is almost ridiculously loaded with great performances, a lot of them from former sitcom stars. Ted Danson of Cheers plays Lou's father-in-law, the town sheriff. Gene Smart of Designing Women plays the matriarch of a local crime family. Brad Garrett of Everybody Loves Raymond plays an incoming mobster from Kansas City. But there are non-sitcom actors, too, and their portrayals are just as funny and unpredictable. Jesse Plemons, Kirsten Dunst, Jeffrey Donovan. They're all worthy of mention, populating a town and a series that rewards you no matter where you look. Here's an example of exactly what I mean. In the premiere episode, the youngest son of the local crime family, played by Kieran Culkin, visits the Waffle Hut to grab some private time with a local judge, played by Ann Cusack, who's eating a burger alone. His goal is to threaten her into reversing a ruling that threatens his business plans. But it turns out she's a lot tougher and scarier than he is.
Hi.
No.
What do you mean, no?
Whatever you're selling, I ain't buying.
First of all, I'm not selling anything. And second...
You need to make me another burger. This one's a coaster.
Yes, ma'am.
Hey, Your Majesty... You're going to change your mind about something, a case.
Or what?
Or you'll find out is what. This isn't one of those optional check A or B scenarios. I'm going to change your mind.
One day, the devil came to God and said, "Let's make a bet between you and me for the soul of a man." And from on high, they looked down on Job, a devout man, religious. And the devil said, "I can change his mind and make him curse your name." And God said, "Try and you will only fail." So the devil begins. He kills Job's herds and takes his fields. He plagues him with boils and throws him on the ash heap. But Job's mind remains unchanged. So I ask you, son, if the devil couldn't change Job's mind, how the hell are you going to change mine?
That's a great scene, and it's only getting started. And these aren't even major characters. But every character in Fargo is worth watching. And because this is a season-long anthology series, every character, minor or major, risks not surviving a tense confrontation. Well, except for Lou Salverson, whom we know will live because he shows up as an older man in season one. Here's a taste from episode two, when Ted Danson as Sheriff Hank Larson stops Bokeem Woodbine as visiting bad guy Mike Milligan and his two silent thugs on a desolate, snowy country road. The dialogue is polite, but the sense of danger is palpable.
What's this about, Sheriff, if I'm okay to ask?
Now, if I were to search you three, would I find weapons?
Sir, you have nothing to fear from us. We're just passing through town on our way to Point South. Thought we'd stop for some waffles. Gail's idea. Heard you had some real good ones around here. So you can imagine our surprise when we find the place closed and apparently the scene of a crime.
What size shoes you boys wear?
Now, that is a truly odd question.
The simultaneous humor and suspense here is a hard act to carry off, but it's done flawlessly and consistently. This season of Fargo may be the closest thing I've seen to Twin Peaks since Twin Peaks. It's that singularly stylized, that oddball and endearing in its dialogue and performances, and that instantly addictive.
David Bianculli is the founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches television and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, the story of a right-wing religious zealot and the leader he assassinated. We talk with journalist Dan Efron. His new book is about the 1995 assassination of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and the ultra-Orthodox young Jewish man who killed him. Efron served as the Jerusalem bureau chief for Newsweek and the Daily Beast. I hope you'll join us. I'm Terry Gross.